Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt. This is another episode for Beyond the Mekong. And with me today is Judah Tana. Now, Judah is with Global Advanced Projects. He's a specialist in human trafficking, forced criminality. And he has been based around Mae Sot, the Thai-Burma frontier, for the last 2 decades. Judah, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
As we both know, that human trafficking has changed enormously over the last few years, particularly since COVID, and the way the criminal networks have taken it over, and it's evolved more and more into scam compounds. You've seen a lot of this. You've rescued, as I understand it, hundreds of people. What is the situation now, and how is it evolving looking ahead?
Yeah, I think the system that's in play now that we see along this border region of Thailand and Myanmar and the wider Mekong region, it far beyond blows our imagination of what it's become.
Right.
We look at it as being one of the largest human trafficking events in history, with more than 400,000 people being moved from over now 60 countries into this region in order to be forced into scamming. The problem in it is that it goes beyond what we would have normally associated with scamming. Because of the AI technologies, with the advancement of technologies, these criminal enterprise groups, these which come from the Chinese crime syndicates, they have spent millions of dollars in the development of high-end AI in order to be in front of every country that's in the world right now. And so when going into meetings with local law enforcement, or even in international meetings of government groups and government minds, we look at it being about 2 years behind. We're about 2 years behind the technologies that they have in these scam compounds. And so they're so sophisticated, even the idea of how they capture these victims of human trafficking, how they entice them to these job offers. It's not about enticing a naive person that's looking for a job. They are focused on PhD holders, people that have master's degrees, educated people, in order to come and work in these machines, these centers, which sole purpose is to reach out to every corner of the earth and basically trick people by using technologies that are so far advanced into releasing their money, into investments, into cryptocurrency, into real estate investments, and it just keeps going. And it seems like there is really
love
no
scams
end.
Shame scams.
Yeah,
I was down on the Burma border about a month and a half ago in this particular area, and there was a Chinese casino and like an entire city built behind it. I was absolutely gobsmacked by the sheer size and how many people these, like what we call compounds, or even SEZs, the special economic zones. I was staggered by the sheer size.
It's unbelievable. Most people, even the people in the compound, don't realize how big they are because they're not able to walk around. But we have people that study these compounds and then come and actually stand in front of them at the river, and they're silenced by the sheer size of them. To see as far as the eye can see, east to west,
right,
these mega cities that have been built now, just in the shortest amount of time, 3 years, and they've taken up hundreds of acres of land, and there's just skyscrapers and buildings and units housing tens of thousands of people whose sole job is scamming. It blows your mind. And it's just like you said, you stand there and you're gobsmacked by what you see.
Yeah.
And there's not one of them. There's not two of them. There's not 10. There's not 20. There's not 30. There's even in our region more than 40 centers that are developed.
Right.
And all of them are just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's just along our river system. Then you've got Cambodia, you've got Laos, you've got China border, Myanmar, Thailand. And now we're seeing them move into the Philippines, Sri Lanka. There seems to just be this, you know, continuation of development and growth.
And the United States Institute for Peace came out the other day with their latest report, naming Myanmar, Cambodia and Laos as the epicenter for human trafficking. And what they're saying is basically the greatest growing threat to global security. It's extraordinary. What are some of the worst examples you have witnessed when it comes to the victims of these organised crime gangs.
Right. The stories that we hear really go beyond even what my imagination could have thought of.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the scam centres, when they first begin, begin with such trauma and abuse within the centres. So you're saying, like, what's the worst? I mean, you dream up the worst and it gets worse than that.
Right.
But we're seeing often in some of the scam centres in the south of our region, it's often they have this dark room that they call. And so you'll be put in this prison, which is a black room, no lights, and you'll be hanged from the ceiling with cuffs around your wrist. For 4 or 5 days, your arms are never let down. You won't be allowed to fall asleep, so every hour they change out the guard, and if you do fall asleep, you end up being tasered. So these guys and women are coming out with just scars all over their body from being tasered for days on end to keep them awake. And then they take scalpels and they cut their legs, so the blood starts to flow down their legs. It's a form of abuse. It's a form
of... It's absolute torture.
From there, they're not given food or water, and when they finally beg for it, the military, they pee into a cup they offer them to drink it. And these guys might be able to handle a day without water.
Yep.
They might even go into the 48 hours. But after some point, they give up hope of ever living. And the only thing of substance that they can get is urine in a cup. And so they choose to drink it. They come out with such trauma and shame from that particular situation. But then it goes beyond that. We have women that are just beaten black and blue from top to bottom. We have men that have tried to jump for freedom. So they literally jump off a second story building. They break their legs on the fall.
Mm-hmm.
They're captured and then they're beaten so badly that their pelvis is broken. Their arms are broken. Then they're dumped somewhere. And that's really where our team comes along, the other partners that I work with on the field, where we come along and we help them get into hospital, help them with the recovery, and then furthermore into repatriation. But I've had a victim that she was used particularly for developing AI technologies. And so for her to keep working as a control, they used to bring people into her room and beat them even to death, so that she would continue to work.
Whoa.
And she'd wake up one morning and just say, I don't want to do this, you've got to let me go. And they'd bring someone in on her team and they'd beat them to death and they'd say, that's your fault. Now keep working 16 hours, otherwise it'll happen to the next person. And she almost, it became her duty to keep them alive. And the only way she did that is develop technologies, and she had a PhD in IT.
And I would assume that the lucky ones who have been rescued, their bodies may not be that good once they're out. I think you were saying in an earlier conversation that one chap, after being hung, shackled above in handcuffs, that he lost the use of both his arms.
Yeah, we took him into the hospital to see, first the emergency hospital, and they referred him to a specialist. And unfortunately, after having all the scans done and that, he had been left for too long for there ever to be recovery. So he had complete paralysis from his shoulders down to his fingers. And it was terribly sad. He was just a young 20-something that thought that he was coming as a call center job and found himself hanged in a black room. And when he finally got cut down, he was unable to feel his arms. They paid, I think, $7,000, his family, to get him cut down from that roof. And they left him so many days after, before he was allowed to be dropped into Methot. The time period that they took meant that what surgical things needed to be done, it was too late, and the paralysis would be permanent. And he had to go home. Knowing that, he had to go home with not only the scars, the emotional scars he carried from the abuse, the physical ones that go into his future. And unfortunately, he comes from a very difficult country, a country that is in civil war at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so his idea of trying to get out for a better life, he's being returned now, not even as a complete man any longer that can work. He's not able to look after himself any longer.
Right. What is the process, in as much as you can talk about, but how do you rescue someone from a compound? Is there a typical way?
Yeah, so really, it's very difficult. The area in which we work, the borderline, is closed, you can't possibly just go to that area. And within where the Chinese have got control, it's under ethnic armed forces, which the Myanmar government, Burmese government, say they have no control over. Thailand's not allowed to enter the country. So really, you've got no law enforcement willing to assist you in the rescues. So what we've learnt now is it really does have more to do with the negotiations that they can hold with these so-called HR systems within the compounds.
Right.
So those mean that there is going to be some ransom they're going to need to pay, some fee in order to get out, $5,000, $7,000, $10,000, even up to $20,000 to be able to get free. That is really one of the only ways now in which they can buy their freedom. They say that you need to otherwise work your contract, whether it's a year or 18 months, but we find that even the victims now that have stood there and worked for the whole year now get told you still can't leave, and they still have to pay the ransom.
Right.
And so the idea is that you connect with their families, so they might reach out to us, we reach out to their family members, and we explain the situation, that it's genuine, that it's a life and death situation, and encourage their families that perhaps this is one way forward. We also work with a number of countries, embassies are being involved.
That's where I wanted to go next.
The problem is that the embassies aren't able to go in to help them. They're bound by diplomatic rules there are in place.
Right.
And so the embassies have to reach out to us because they're not able to go into this region. They're not able to just get on in a car and drive down here. So they often reach out to us and can you help us with negotiations? Can you help us with that? So what happens is we essentially talk to the victims inside, give them a measure of hope, because the whole plan of the system is that you remove all hope, but you keep just enough that they'll keep working. Because otherwise the other side of it is you get victims that suicide, right? Because there's no other hope. They give them just a glimmer of hope, and that might be that they're able to connect with their family members for an hour in the evening. And that gives them that there's hope that their families still love them, that they're out there. And so we work with them, and eventually they negotiate a release plan.
Right.
They will often send us then their location, and we'll track them as they come out of the compounds. They are usually then dumped at some location in our region, and that's where we move in and we would pick them up. We give them 24 to 72 hour care. What they need is to eat and sleep.
Right.
Before they can even fathom what the next steps are. And the next steps are either registering and going through the national referral mechanism, which allows them to register as victims of human trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
But that process is long. You're looking at maybe 2-3 months if they are even accepted as trafficked victims. Otherwise, it's immigration violations.
So they could be held.
Immigration violations means they will be going to court and they will be going to jail eventually to IDC, which is the detention center, and then deported. For them to really understand that process and be okay with it, it has to be explained. How many days am I going to be here? What's going to happen? How is my transport going to be? Because they've come from a situation where they're so traumatized. They don't want to trust anyone. They don't want to believe anyone. And they're terrified of prison. But what we do in that 72 hours is give them a set concrete foundation. Whichever way they go, they know the plan. And we're able to action out what that looks like for them. We're able to talk to their families. Everybody understands the timing. And they start to get enough strength to walk through that process before they end up going home.
Right. It was only a couple of years ago when most of those victims were from Southeast Asia, then China. There was a lot of pressure brought on to the Cambodian authorities, and the recruiters switched to Central Asia, Sri Lankans, Pakistanis, Indians. And now, as you were just saying, and according to the US IP report that I mentioned earlier, the victims are coming from like 60 countries, including Uganda, Morocco, across Africa. It's absolutely extraordinary. And there doesn't seem to be a system in place that would enable the various embassies or the governments to kind of get involved, intervene. I mean, Myanmar's on the verge of being a failed state. We're sitting in Mae Sot. We're 20 kilometres south of Shwe Koko, where I remember being told that there were 10,000 being held there. That was about 12 months ago. And the idea of 10,000 people being held in one compound, I found at that time incredulous. But now, it just seems like a spit in the ocean. It's tiny. What should be done next? There's obviously a role for international policing, Interpol and the authorities. There's also the Chinese are trying to get more involved through their law enforcement, and I don't think anyone would begrudge them that. What has to be done next?
Yeah, I think the difficulty is that everyone has a right to travel.
Right.
And in most cases previously, when you're looking at forced criminality or we're looking at human trafficking, it was always done in the shadows.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's not.
Right.
Now the jobs are being offered on mainstream. And so to pick and choose between which ones are scams and which ones are genuine is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
The centres are so set up, so sophisticated. They do job interviews on Zoom. They give you documents to sign, contracts. You can look up addresses of buildings. They exist. You can look up phone numbers. You can call them. You can check on the website. Everything is laid out for them to look genuine.
Right.
And you would have no clue either way. And so a government can't stop somebody from applying for a job. And the wonderful part of our world is we are becoming a world where born in one country, study in another, and then move and work somewhere globally.
Mm-hmm.
It's a global market. And so it is normal for these countries, like you said, Uganda or Morocco, it is normal for these countries, for these educated university graduates, to find jobs elsewhere. And so they use recruiting companies, which are legitimate globally,
mm-hmm.
in order to get jobs somewhere else. So it's not so far-fetched that they actually take a job in Thailand in a call center that would tick all the boxes that they wanted for their career or their job. And so they get on that flight and they come. It's too difficult to police because there's no shadows in which we're looking.
Right.
It's right there out in the open. What do we need to do is, I think, obviously prevention's a huge part. Governments perhaps are a bit lax on really getting the message out there to help stop their citizens from really going after these jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, when they get here and then they get trafficked down into Myanmar, and then over into, trafficked down into Mesot, and then over into Myanmar.
Right.
Essentially, there's nothing more a government can do. They can't diplomatically step over that line and start to work in another country without an invitation. So it's hard to imagine really what the next step is. You've got governments that are looking at the technologies and really trying to go after that, understanding where the money's being laundered, how it's being moved through Go or online accounts, all those things. One of the last reports from Interpol, I think, said $3 trillion in the year to do with scams and to do with this online criminal network system. We thought it was a big number when it got to $200 billion.
Right.
We thought it was unimaginable.
Yep.
These governments are running to try to catch up and figure out what's going on. And then you've got the countries who are looking at their citizens that are travelling globally and trying to understand how are we going to prevent that. But I think the conversation needs to be had within our countries, whether it's in our newspapers, on our televisions, in our news reports, at our airports.
Yep.
You know, before you get on that flight, if you end up in Mesot, you're in the wrong place. Don't get on the boat. It's such a simple tagline. But a lot of these victims, they don't really know what's happening. But
they do
learn that they get to Mesot.
Yeah.
Only they're unknowing. If at that moment they knew don't get on the boat, they could actually prevent all of the next months or years that they have in captivity in this actual human trafficking crime syndicate inside these compounds. They could help themselves by just understanding they've, you know, jumping out before it's too late.
It's like trying to fight this new brand of criminality with old school tools. In a way, I do wonder whether there's a place for them in that if you were a foreign worker 10, 20 years ago and you arrived in a foreign country, there could be someone from the government there waiting for you. There would be a place where you were interviewed, you were stamped, you were checked, here are your tax papers, bank account, all these sorts of things that go to having an identity in a foreign country where you have purpose and you need to be fit for purpose. But when it comes to anything to do with technology, this all seems to be swept away in favour of just bring in the tech guys, We've got 5,000-10,000 of them. Bring them in, bring them in. And it's extraordinary what's happening in the middle of this.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that, because it's an idea that I had had in a meeting that we held with some government members of another country. And the idea was, what could you do? And it's such a simple thought, but Meersut being a major region in which they traffic people through, it's a transit region into Myanmar because it's along this borderline. And the question was, is how does several hundred thousand people pass through a town and not one person noticed?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the joke of it, right?
Yeah.
Is not one person noticed that they were here and they were gone before it was too late. Yet I had suggested that, how about you just put up a tent at the checkpoint? The thing about moving into Meersut is you pass three checkpoints before you arrive in Meersut. There's no other way in.
Right.
So those checkpoints are supposed to check your IDs. They're supposed to check your nationality, check your visas, check your processes, what you're doing. If you had a tent set up by embassies, and it could be a joint task amongst many embassies that staff it, you know, and just one single tent, it sounds so old school in a sense, because it's not computers, it's not scanning, it's not... And simply walk up to the car and say, here's a leaflet, here's a pamphlet on human trafficking, don't get on the boat. And then it would really be up to them then. They can really decide if they do want to continue on, now knowing that they're in court within this human trafficking thing. But there is no, let's say, we've rescued hundreds of Ethiopians. There's no jobs for the Ethiopians here. So when you find them in a van and there's seven of them coming into your township in a van, you can pretty much be assured they're here to be trafficked into Myanmar.
And you can ask them, why are you here?
Exactly. If we were had embassies that approached the government and said, let's set up a tent on the main road coming in, I think it could... It's so layman. It's so right back there in the old, you know, Stone Ages. But I think it would be effective. And that perhaps could be where we are all needing to go. The technologies are so advancing in the way that the scams and systems are working. Maybe we need to use...
Go back.
Go backwards just, in time and use paper and pen in order to break the system.
Again, the USIP report, what I found interesting about that was its focus on Americans. And, okay, three quarters of the report was... dedicated to these countries are bad, this is horrible, the money's extraordinary, but the Americans are they're an interesting lot. And the final quarter of that report was dedicated to the damage these people are causing to the American economy and the victims in America. Now, when the Americans start focusing on that angle, that also adds an impetus for Congress to do something, because it might sound a little bit lame, but you know, our Americans are in trouble. They're attacking our homeland. I'm wondering if we could see a lot more sanctions coming out of the United States, and even economic sanctions through the US Fed Reserve. I mean, someone has to tackle this extraordinary amount of money that's going through the system.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think in two parts, you know, like you said, that particular article was based very primarily on US. Well, it was written by the US.
Yeah.
I think what we need to be careful is to make sure that we don't misunderstand that it's the global issue. It's just looking at their particular market.
I agree,
country that's missing on it.
Right.
And it's the same thing as when we look at Myanmar, we look at Cambodia. A lot of people say, oh, Cambodia's numbers are going up, Myanmar must be going down. It's not true. What's happening is that both centres are growing at an astronomical rate. It's not that, you know, at one stage Cambodia did lessen and then Myanmar built.
Right.
But they're essentially together and not. They're both growing. And that's the same thing as looking at where the damage is going, which country is hurting more. We look at the US, but it doesn't mean that Australia is not hurting. It doesn't mean
Australia is hurting.
It
look at the next level above the human trafficking comes the money laundering, and now that's being tied to all the
language. Almost every country on this earth that is being attacked by these particular crime syndicates. And I think America is still our big brother. for the world, really. Right. And I think, like you said, if they stand up and start to put sanctions, countries follow. Whether we agree or disagree with the politics in America, it's irrelevant in a situation like this. But they still do hold this special type of power and this special type of influence in the world. And I'm glad that they are looking into this more. I'm glad that I've had the privilege of speaking at their embassies on these issues. And I'm glad that they're sending people from Washington here really to look in and really dive into it, because they need to start putting up sanctions. They need to start, you know, stopping the bank systems and stopping the transfers and looking at it as a whole, so that the other smaller countries can all move behind the wave and get involved in the same kind of measure, I think.
Right, and I suggest the United States simply because I don't believe the United Nations, as high-minded as their principles might be, I don't think they have the logistics capability or the political will to act.
Yeah, they don't. The UN is able to collect a lot of the data. The UN is in place in finding a lot of facts and really searching out what's happening within the systems, so that they can hand that information to countries and countries can take that information and run with it. So I know that they have these great meetings run by the UN in like the Philippines, where a lot of Asian countries come. They have gone through collecting so much data and information affecting all of those nations, ready to hand it to them, waiting for those countries to take action. And that's really the place of, I think, the UN's position in this, is that they do have researchers that have done a great job in finding out exactly all of that stuff. It's now up to the country leaders in order to take it that step further and look at how they can actually make a dent in this system.
And the role of law enforcement, by that I mean Interpol, seems to have been a major player in a lot of rescues that have taken place over the last 2 to 3 years, but they say very little. And that could be for very good reasons as well. I'm not casting any aspersions.
Yeah, as being someone that's involved with this particular human trafficking for forced criminality on the borders of Burma, I have really not seen Interpol much.
Right.
In broad meetings that host international governance coming to meet, or more in the private areas of you know, private meetings, I really haven't seen or heard of Interpol much. I often get asked by victims, oh, I'll contact Interpol, they'll do something. Unfortunately, in my situation, I haven't seen that. It's not something that I've been able to, in the last year and a half, see them take any efforts in trying to combat what's happening now. Again, I think that they're a bit at a loss of what to do, personally. I think that they're unsure. And it's the same thing with local law enforcement. Like we've hosted groups from the FBI who have come to look into it, and they come kind of on these learning trips to try to figure out what's really happening, and they go away going, where am I even going to start? Where do we even make a dent into this? And so I think that that's unfortunate, that we have some major law enforcements globally that are not really sure how to combat the issue.
Right. You're a victim of human trafficking. You're sitting out there in a casino or recently built city in Myanmar, which is totally absorbed with a civil war. What is your advice to these people?
I talk to victims daily inside the centre. I have talked to them and given them hope. I've talked to them and stopped them from jumping from buildings, taking their own lives, swallowing razor blades, essentially talking them off the ledge. When you're sitting there, it's an unfortunate, it's not really the right word, but when they're sitting there, they really only have one choice, and it is a choice of life and death. And that's what I want listeners to really understand. It's not that they could just stop working. They stop working, they die. They're actually murdered or tortured so badly that they wish that they were. So their only choice is to keep working. They show up to work and they keep working. That keeps them alive. The second part is that really only if they can manage to collect enough to pay the ransom can they get free. And those are the two real things that are left for them today. They have to show up and go to work to stay alive, and they have to beg family to come up with some kind of way of being able to pay their captors to let them out.
And just on a final note, how many people do you think are currently in these compounds?
I've heard numbers thrown around, and even the last few days, I was asked about a particular country, and I have personal contact with maybe 20 or 30 from that country.
Mm-hmm.
And this person reached out and asked and said, oh, they believe 158 are in the compound.
Right.
So when I go, well, I think at least in my region, my small region, I think there would be a low estimate of 180 to 200,000 people trapped. I remember that I only knew 20 out of the 158. And so I think my estimate of 180 to 200,000 people is a low estimate of what really is being held inside these centres.
Judah Tana, thank you. It's been an extraordinary conversation.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I hope the listeners have really learned something about this.